This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Another hour of the Jesse Kelly Show on a fantastic Monday. Now, we have all kinds of political stuff we're going to talk about this hour, but we have to put a pause on those things because you know what time it is. It's Medal of Honor Monday time. We'll get back to the institution and the lies and everything else, but for right now, it's Medal of Honor Monday time. Every single Monday, start of the second hour, we do the exact same thing. We pick a hero. We honor his sacrifice. We honor his service. Today, we're going to honor a David Richard Kingsley. He was born in Portland, Oregon, 1918. Remember this. Being in an airplane in World War II, of any kind, was a very, very dangerous affair. We had personnel die flying back home on hospital planes, getting shot at. There's no armor. It was unbelievably dangerous. The 8th Air Force, those were the ones doing the bombing runs over Germany, had more men die than the Marines did fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. Did you know that? That's how insanely dangerous it was. These guys died at such an alarming rate that they would get sent back home after they reached a certain number of missions. After a certain number of missions, they just said, man, you're on borrowed time. Go home because you ain't making it very much longer. Very dangerous. Frightening. For many people, taking off and landing in an airplane, maybe just flying in it itself, is scary. Yeah, let's drop the temperatures to like 20 below. Let's have what essentially amounts to grenade explosions. That would be flak. Grenade explosions all around you. Other fighter jets firing machine guns into you. It's horrific. And if your plane becomes disabled and begins to collapse, you have a long time to sit and dwell on your end. It's not going to come in 10 seconds. You are going to slowly descend to the earth. Ugly, ugly, ugly stuff, and they all knew it. So, let's read about David Richard Kingsley.
Ready, aim, fire.
Honoring those who went above and beyond, it's Medal of Honor Monday.
For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in action at the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty on the 23rd of June, 1944, near Ploiești, Romania, while flying as a bombardier of a B-17 type aircraft. That would be the B-17 Flying Fortress, by the way, our heavy bomber. On the bomb run, 2nd Lieutenant Kingsley's aircraft was severely damaged by intense flak and forced to drop out of formation. But the pilot proceeded over the target, and 2nd Lieutenant Kingsley successfully dropped his bombs, causing severe damage to vital installations. The damaged aircraft, forced to lose altitude and lag behind the formation, was aggressively attacked by three ME-109 aircraft, causing more damage to the aircraft and severely wounding the tail gunner in the upper arm. The radio operator and engineer notified 2nd Lieutenant Kingsley that the tail gunner had been wounded and that assistance was needed to check the bleeding. 2nd Lieutenant Kingsley made his way back to the radio room, skillfully applied first aid to the wound, and succeeded in checking the bleeding. The tail gunner's parachute harness and heavy clothes were removed, and he was covered with blankets, making him as comfortable as possible. 8 ME-109 aircraft again aggressively attacked 2nd Lieutenant Kingsley's aircraft, and the ball turret gunner was wounded by 20mm shell fragments. The ball turret gunner is the guy who was in the ball underneath the plane. Very dangerous job. He went forward to the radio room to have 2nd Lieutenant Kingsley administer first aid.
A few minutes later, when the pilot gave the order to prepare to bail out, Second Lieutenant Kingsley immediately began to assist the wounded gunners in putting on their parachute harness. In the confusion, the tail gunner's harness, believed to have been damaged, could not be located in the bundle of blankets and flying clothes which had been removed from the wounded men. With utter disregard for his own means of escape, Second Lieutenant Kingsley unhesitatingly removed his parachute harness and adjusted it to the wounded tail gunner. Due to the extensive damage caused by the accurate and concentrated 20mm fire by the enemy aircraft, the pilot gave the order to bail out as it appeared the aircraft would disintegrate any moment. Second Lieutenant Kingsley aided the wounded men in bailing out, and when last seen by his crew members, he was standing on the bomb bay catwalk. The aircraft, by the way, the bomb bay is the doors that open under, obviously, where the bombs drop out. And there's a divider you can stand on. That would be, if you could, where you would bail out. You'd drop out of the bottom of that in your parachute, all right? The aircraft continued to fly on automatic pilot for a short distance, then crashed and burned. His body was later found in the wreckage. Second Lieutenant Kingsley, by his gallant and heroic action, was directly responsible for saving the life of the wounded gunner. Imagine that kind of bravery. In the middle of that kind of combat, airplane possibly about to come apart in the sky, and you take off your one chance at survival and strap it to your buddy. You then help him out of the plane and say, good luck, boys. You have no chance. Zero. Zun. None. You give your life for your friend. That's amazing. And the man deserves taps, doesn't he? In case you are wondering, just a little tidbit on logistics and why these planes would find themselves in these situations. Remember that this is a different era for airplanes. Different era when it came to communication, radar, things like that. Airplanes of any kind, Pacific, Europe, fighters, bombers, if they were wounded or even just got confused or something, they would lose the other airplanes and you're on your own. If there's an airplane that's too badly wounded, you have to leave them behind for the good of every other aircraft. You would know, all your fellow flyers, you would have to say, hey man, we gotta go. Goodbye. I'm sorry. And good luck. That's one. Now, what is that moment like when you're in the plane that has been wounded and you know there are enemy planes still out there, and the rest of the formation takes off, and now you're alone. You're alone, surrounded by enemies. And maybe you're wondering, where were our fighter planes? That was a never-ending challenge during World War II. It always has been, always will be a challenge. Finding a plane, especially a fighter plane, that had the fuel range to stay with the bombers. The bombers, like a B-17, has four big engines, can hold all kinds of fuel. You can't have a fighter plane like that, or it wouldn't be able to move and fight like a fighter plane. It can't hold that much fuel. We couldn't send our fighters to escort our bombers
as far as the bombers went. So you would have a fighter escort for a while, but eventually your fighter escort has to go back home because they're out of gas, and now you're a big fat cow in the sky, and you have a bunch of wolves surrounding you, and those friggin' Germans, they knew what they were doing. It was just, those guys are absurdly brave. If it's a subject that interests you, please pick up books on it or watch a documentary or listen to something. Jewish producer Chris does audiobooks, as you know. The air war over Europe, absurd. Crazy cool. All right, we're going to talk about lies because a member of the media is complaining right now about our lack of trust. So we're going to touch on institutional trust again. Before we touch on that, I don't know about you. Me personally, ever since COVID, I've started to lack trust in our traditional medical institutions for obvious reasons. And I really have grown jaded on drugs. I'm not talking about Pablo Escobar. I'm talking about the legal pharmaceuticals out there. Not that they don't serve a purpose for a lot of people, but I try to find drug-free solutions whenever I have a problem. I love Relief Factor because for the longest time, Americans have been reaching for drugs, legal ones, to ease the pain. The pain that nags at you every day, the pain that holds you back from doing things in your life. Relief Factor is the drug-free way to eliminate it permanently. What if you could be pain-free again? Do you even remember what that's like? Try Relief Factor. It's a supplement. Every day for 3 weeks, try it. 1-800-4-RELIEF or go to relieffactor.com. We'll be back.
Get the cure for rhinos. Weekdays with the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful, fantastic Monday. Don't forget, you can email the show, jesse@jessekellyshow.com, and we will get to a bunch of those. Now, one of our oldest... Triest, I don't think that's a word. Truest things we have, that's what I was trying to say. Truest things we have on the soundboard is this little tidbit you've heard many times before. Now, in case you're wondering who this is, her name is Catherine Mayer. She's actually the head of NPR, which is a whole other set of problems. But she got a little too honest, giving a speech one day, and she said this. You know how I say communists lie about everything all the time? She kind of tells you why.
I think our reverence for the truth might have become a bit of a distraction that is preventing us from finding consensus and getting important things done.
Let me play it for you again. Why do you lie about everything all the time? How could you justify that in your mind when you just tell these lies about huge lies? How could you justify it?
I think our reverence for the truth might have become a bit of a distraction that is preventing us from finding consensus and getting important things done.
Yeah. Now, there's a cost to lying. In fact, I'll play you another good one. Do you remember Jasmine Crockett, the race communist in Texas? Always, always, always complaining, black this and black that, and black, I mean, she's this person.
You know, there are those that have their own motivations for critiquing, and you know, I think that the people
is it
smarter.
Just racism and sexism? Like, what do you think it is?
I mean, I think there's a lot of things. I think it depends on who it's coming from. But I've been a black woman my whole life. So this idea that I'm going to go and be like, oh, well, they're being racist or misogynistic towards me. Like, you think I didn't know I was a black woman when I woke up and decided
We got it. She's just a race communist. That's all she is. Very useful for the cause, for the revolution. Remember when Jasmine Crockett got up on the House floor after the Jeffrey Epstein stuff came out? And she blamed Lee Zeldin, said Lee Zeldin was part of it? Remember that? We played the audio of it back in the day. She said, well, it's Lee Zeldin and Jeffrey Epstein. Only, oops, it wasn't the right Jeffrey Epstein. there are many Jeffrey Epsteins. I mean, I'm assuming it's a fairly common name. It's not that uncommon. But she just got up and told a lie. This
This was her being asked about it.
But, you know, when I see the moment on the House where you seem to accuse Republican Lee Zeldin of taking money from Jeffrey Epstein, but it seemed like if it was not the same person, I wonder, like, is there times in which the rhetoric goes too far? Are there times in which you should say, you know, maybe I messed that one up?
No, not in this environment. I don't. I think that, you know, we are really in uncharted territory.
I told an outright lie. Do you regret that? She did not have done that? Well, no. I'm in uncharted territory. The revolution is too important. They justify it in their minds because they're fighting a revolution they believe is bigger and more important than things like the truth. They believe the communist revolution they are fighting is bigger and more important than anything. So we got all that. But here is the problem the communist always runs into. That's why there is always a shelf life on communist revolutions, on communist regimes. There is always a shelf life, always has been, always will be, because the communist fundamentally misunderstands something. He understands a lot of things about human nature, but he does not understand this part. Institutional trust is the power the institution has. He gets that much. The institutions that are out there, the only power they have is the trust people give them. If people stop trusting them, the institutional power completely disappears. Gone, over, done. Harvard. Harvard's actually a perfect example of this. My entire life, Harvard was the elite of the elite. That's where only the best and the brightest went and whatnot. But Harvard pretended, convinced itself that that would always be the case. Then they started kicking all the Asians off of campus, started bringing in people who weren't qualified to be there. Slowly but surely, Harvard is becoming something people scoff at. That trust was the power of Harvard. Being able to say, you have your degree behind you. I graduated Harvard. That was its power, the reverence, the trust people gave it. What the communist doesn't understand is that's not permanent. The communist thinks institutional trust is permanent, and he treats institutional trust as if it is permanent when it is anything but permanent. The institution only ever gained its trust because it was honest, because it was good, because it did things that were good and right and better for society. Harvard only ever became Harvard because Harvard not only took in the best and brightest, Harvard was graduating the best and brightest, and they would go on and do wonderful things in society, and they would lead this, and they'd be this, and they would do that, and therefore Harvard's brand only increased the better it did. But Harvard made the same mistake every single communist makes forever. Harvard thought it could last no matter what Harvard did. And that's simply not true. Once Harvard kicked all the Asians out and started bringing in all the DEI hires who can't do basic math, well, the brand started to fade. It's fading now. There's a great lesson for Peggy Noonan. Talk about that lesson next.
The Jesse Kelly Show.
I like it.
Returns next.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a magnificent Monday. Don't forget, if you miss any part of the show, you can download it iHeart, Spotify, iTunes. So Peggy Noonan is one of these journalist types. She has a quote out there, and I just don't think she understands. Here's the quote. I fear sometimes that few people really care about journalism, but we are dead without it. Someday, something bad will happen, something terrible on a national scale, and the thing we'll need most, literally to survive, is information. Reliable information, a way to get it, and then to get it to the public. That is what journalism is, getting the information. No, Peggy. That's what journalism was. And more specifically, let's be honest, that's how Peggy and all the mainstream journalism types, that's how they want you to view journalism. But journalism isn't trusted anymore because of the conduct of journalists. You communists thought you could take over the journalism schools, you could take over all the media, all the major corporate press, from television to newspapers. You thought you could conquer all these revered institutions and then use them for the communist revolution, and the trust people gave that institution wouldn't go anywhere. You thought you could lie about everything all the time and the institutional trust would be etched in stone. But that's not how human beings work. Institutional trust can disappear way faster than it is earned. Way faster. It takes years and years and years of trust to actually give that institution true power. And that trust can disappear like that. Remember Catherine Herridge? She was a wonderful journalist for CBS. She's an investigative journalist. I want you to listen to what she said about CBS. Now, keep in mind, we know from the numbers that came out after, if you set aside all the election cheating, Joe Biden doesn't, quote, win the 2020 election if the society, if American society knows about Hunter Biden's laptop, Joe Biden's son, all kinds of felonies, ugly pictures on there. Joe Biden never walks into the White House. We get 8 straight years of Donald Trump. We never get 20 million new foreigners. We don't get all these things we would have missed out on. Why didn't the American public know? Hey, Catherine, why didn't we know?
When we did the story, we did it after the midterms. I argued against that because it was ready before the midterms. And my training is that you should always do the story when it's ready to go. You should not be dictated by the political cycle. I spent a lot of my time at CBS following the Hunter Biden story. And one of the things that really struck me is this kind of disconnect. I didn't understand how a senior executive like George Chiefs could tell me that this was a high priority for the network and for his boss. And yet the executives at CBS News, show producers, anchors could refuse that. I came to the conclusion that they must have felt that they were more powerful than George Chiefs, which was astonishing to me. I'd never worked at a place where a directive from the top would be so defied.
Catherine tells us more.
Once we got the laptop story on the morning news, I felt that there was so much there that we could still do. For example, in the text messages, there's unfortunately the use of the N-word, the liberal use of the N-word. And I thought this was worthy of a story, but I was told that it was not something that interested CBS News. Then I asked for a forensic review of the laptop, and we found that there were more than half a dozen emails that were likely used by Joe Biden. I thought that was a story. But the answer that came back was, well, we need to know what the content is of the emails. But that was going to be a years-long process. So there was no way. So there were a lot of reasons I was told not to do it, not to pursue it.
The communists who run the American media, they thought they could take it over and use that institution however they wanted, including lying about everything all the time. And that will work for a period of time. But eventually, the lies will come get you. The people will remove their trust from the institution, and the institution only has the power if the people trust it. What is CBS? What is CBS if the American public, if enough people in the American public think they're a bunch of dirty commie liars? What does CBS become? Nothing. Becomes nothing. What is the New York Times, ABC, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, anybody? What does it become? How much power do they have if people change the channel and assume they're lying about everything all the time? They become nothing. Nothing. This show. You listen. Maybe you listen every day. All 3 hours. Maybe not. Maybe it's a 15-minute thing for you. I'm on the way home from work. How long do you keep listening if I start lying? You listen, I'm sure, for a variety of reasons, but You also don't think I lie to you, do you? We've never had that accusation. I have people tell me I'm rude and offensive and everything else. I got all that. I don't care. But we don't ever have somebody tell me I'm lying. What if I started lying? How long would you stick around? I can't start lying because your trust is temporary, always temporary. If violated, you will remove your trust and therefore the power of the show goes bye-bye. But the communist has never gotten, as much as he understands human nature, certainly the most base, horrible parts of human nature. He understands it. He recognizes it. He uses it to his advantage. The communist understands so much about people, but he has never gotten that that institutional trust is the power and that institutional trust can be taken away. So they'll just stand in front of people and say this stuff.
I think our reverence for the truth might have become a bit of a distraction that is preventing us from finding consensus and getting important things done.
Jasmine Crockett, you told an out-and-out lie on the House floor about Lee Zeldin. A totally different Jeffrey Epstein supported Lee Zeldin. Not even the right guy. You lied about it. Black and white lie. Do you regret it?
But you know, when I see the moment on the House where you seem to accuse Republican Lee Zeldin of taking money from Jeffrey Epstein, but it seemed like if it was not the same person, I wonder, like, is there times in which the rhetoric goes too far? Are there times in which you should say, you know, maybe I messed that one up?
No. Not in this environment. I don't. I think that, you know, we are really in uncharted territory.
That's why they lie. They lie because it moves the revolution forward. But the good news is it will always hold them back. It will always put a cap on their revolution. Now, they can do a lot of damage with all those lies before that cap comes. But there's always a short shelf life on it because the trust gets taken away. Eventually, the people in the Soviet Union, they knew the nightly news was mockworthy. Early on, when you're getting the newspaper, you're getting the news, and they're telling you about, we have a record crop again this year. Yeah, that'll work for year one. Year five of starvation rations? You mock what you see on the news. It's not just that all power had been taken away. It had been completely flipped on them. It was beyond powerless. They were nothing. They were the court jesters. All right, we'll get to some emails. I'm behind on those. Next.
Jesse Kelly returns next.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a magnificent, magnificent Monday. If you miss any part of the show, you can download it. iHeart, Spotify, iTunes. All right, let's deal with a heavy one here. Jesse, Trump needs to be a part of this election like he's campaigning for president because that's the only time Norm votes. Then he goes on to talk about how Donald Trump needs to get involved in the midterms and things like that. Okay. So that's true and it's not true. Let me explain. Donald Trump motivates GOP voters in a way other people simply do not and cannot. He's a political phenom. He gets people fired up. The MAGA hats and the big rallies to everything, it gets people fired up. There's no question about that. Donald Trump will get people out there. Donald Trump has already begun midterm campaigning. I'm telling you right now, I'm sure you've probably already heard, there's going to be a midterm Republican convention. That's very abnormal. They save those for the presidential election years. They're going to fire one up before the midterms. All of this is in an effort to get people out, to get people voting in the midterms, to try to avoid Republican losses in the House of Representatives, or maybe at least mitigate Republican losses in the House of Representatives. That's what there's an effort to do. Donald Trump's presence will help. But we can't lose sight of this. You and I always have to remember this horrible fact that I wish wasn't true. You do not decide elections. And I do not decide elections. Hyper-informed political people do not decide elections. You knew who you were going to vote for in the midterms 2 years ago.
right? You know who you're going to vote for in 2028 for president. How do you know that? What, you already know both sides. You know the issues. That you already know. The people who vote and actually decide these things, if of course, if you eliminate cheating and all that, they're the uninformed among us who go out and vote on how they feel about things. And this is why I have warned the Trump administration before about the kind of rhetoric Trump uses when it comes to the economy. What am I saying? Well, Donald Trump, in his way, it's who he is. He's not going to change. But in his way, he's always going to say everything he's involved in is the best ever. It's really, frankly, endearing because everyone gets it by now. Well, this is the best people have ever said. People are saying I'm the best ever. This is the best ever. It's the most beautiful ever. It's the greatest ever. It's how he is. It's everything is the best thing ever. And you get it. Because that's his way, he will talk about the economy like this.
You said you inherited a mess from President Biden when it comes to the economy. But at what point is it on you? At what point are we in the Trump economy?
Oh, I'd say we're there now. I'm very proud of it, 5.6%. And I'm starting to get great polls on the economy,
the polls on the economy they're not great.
They should be great.
They should be. So why aren't they? If you believe that.
I don't know.
They should be great. I'm doing great. I played you all kinds of audio before of him saying this. It's great. It's going great. We should be bragging about it. The economy's great. It's going great. You don't tell people who are hurting. We used to say this about Joe Biden. You don't tell people who are not making ends meet that things are going wonderfully for them. So in case you're wondering, how is this landing with normal people? Here's how it's landing.
This. Yeah, okay. So if you know anything about Donald Trump, you know that he built his two presidential victories on winning voters without a college degree, while Donald Trump's base with non-college voters is absolutely collapsing. What are we talking about here? Well, why don't we just take a look? Voters without a college degree on Donald Trump. Look at this. Back in 2024, he won those voters over Kamala Harris by 14 points. You come over to this side of the screen, what's his net approval rating with him? He is underwater by 9 points. That's a 23-point switcheroo with his base of non-college voters. He is absolutely collapsing with the group of voters that helped put him into the White House.
Okay, stop. That's bad. When it comes to elections, it's catastrophic. Now, let me pause for a moment on what you might be doing. Maybe you're yelling at me or yelling at the radio. Or what you're probably doing, you're yelling at those voters. Oh, are they stupid? It was Joe Biden. Don't they realize it takes time? No. I got it. But they can't hear from the president that everything's great when everything's not. Scott Bessent, to his credit, actually brought it up when they talked about our growth. Well, we have over 4% growth. Scott Bessent came out and admitted, yeah, that was really just the wealthy who kind of got that growth. Working people, the norms and normas out there, working paycheck to paycheck. Maybe that's how you live. It probably is. That's how most people live. Working people, they do not feel like the economy is great. And they don't want to be told the economy is great. They don't want to be told how great the overseas accomplishments are. They have to feel it in their wallet. They have to see it in their lives. And you and I can scream at them until we're blue in the face. No, don't you understand? That's why this trade agreement matters. And you're right. And I'm right. That's not going to move them. That's a very good point, Chris. When was the last time he was able to go out and order a steak? When was the last time? Well, that's not Trump's fault. I know. You're arguing with the wrong person. I'm telling you how people vote. That's how they vote. Why has there been a 23-point swing with non-college educated voters? Because the economy has not improved for them. I know big companies have gotten better. I know it's better for the wealthy. I understand about the trade agreements. And I understand Venezuela, that's super exciting. And the mullahs are angry in Iran. And all these other things. Don't put steak on the table for Norm. And that's how people vote. And because of that, you gotta stop bragging about how great things are. It doesn't land well when things aren't great. It just doesn't. All right, we're moving off this. We still have an hour.